Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This podcast contains graphic content and may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
True North True Crime is produced on the territories of the Coast Salish people.
Like they say, and I know it's a cliche, somebody knows something.
Loving someone who struggles with substance misuse is one of the most challenging things a person can endure. It can feel like a never-ending roller coaster, and one that you have absolutely no control over. A common phrase in the AA or Al-Anon world is, addiction is a family disease. One person may use, but the whole family suffers. The following is a quote from Addict in the Family, Stories of Loss, Hope, and Recovery. Few experiences in life quite match the feelings of horror, fear, helplessness, and grief that families experience when someone they love becomes addicted to alcohol or other drugs. They watch in dismay as the addict becomes alienated from the family and undergoes profound changes. Activities that once brought the addict pleasure are abandoned, old friends are pushed away, and the addict withdraws into a world that is inaccessible to anyone who tries to help. Addiction knows no boundaries. It can ensnare anyone, regardless of their background or achievements. In today's episode, we delve into the gripping reality that even the most brilliant individuals can succumb to the perils of substance misuse. A string of bad decisions or mistakes can change a person's life and lead them down a path that no one could have imagined. One can go from graduating early, meeting the love of their life, and buying a house in their early 20s, to the stark reality of scraping by on the streets, scavenging for survival. Every person you see living with no fixed address has a story, and in this episode, you're going to hear one of them. Tonight, we delve into the disappearance of Michelle Mercer, and you are listening to True North True Crime.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Caitlin, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Graham. Thanks so much for being here. Whether you're a longtime listener or this is your first time with us, we're so happy to have you. If you'd like to give our podcast a little boost, we would encourage you to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, hit subscribe or follow on whichever platform you are currently listening to this episode on, or you can always tell a friend about True North True Crime. This episode is going to be a bit of a unique one, as the story is relatively unknown, and there is very little information about Michelle Mercer online, or anywhere, really. This case came to our attention thanks to Michelle's sister, Tammy. She reached out to us via email, and we're so glad that she made the decision to do so. This is because the story we are covering today is an important one that I think will stick with our audience. To anyone out there who has a case suggestion for us, you can do exactly what Tammy did and send us an email to truenorthtruecrime@gmail.com. We do give priority to family members and those with close connections to the case, but are happy to receive suggestions from all of our listeners. For this episode, we had the privilege of engaging in extensive conversation with Michelle's sister Tammy and her daughter Jackie. Given the scarcity of online information about Michelle and her case, their insights were obviously invaluable. Our discussions with Tammy and Jackie spanned over 2 hours, during which they graciously opened up about their cherished memories of Michelle. We extend our heartfelt gratitude to them for their generosity in sharing Michelle's story with us, and by extension, all of you. You'll be hearing Tammy and Jackie's voices alongside ours for the duration of this episode, but before we dive in, we have some additional content warnings that include alcoholism, substance misuse disorder, drug use, suicide, a fatal car accident, and domestic violence. With that, let's go ahead and get right into this week's episode.
Now, this case takes place in a few different locations across Canada, but Michelle grew up in North Vancouver. Michelle Mercer, born on October 30th, 1961, had the chance to experience North Vancouver before it evolved into the bustling suburban city that it is today. During the 1960s and the 1970s, North Van maintained much of its rural character, but signs of urbanization were on the horizon. The area began attracting more residents, drawn by its natural beauty, convenient proximity to downtown Vancouver, and the development of new suburban housing. To give an idea of how much the area has changed in size, in the 1970s, the population of North Vancouver was somewhere in the neighborhood of 60,000 people, but today its population has more than doubled to roughly 140,000 residents. Anyone who lives in that area will tell you that the road infrastructure has not kept up with the population growth, and almost every day getting to and from North Vancouver will result in bumper-to-bumper traffic. But if you're a nature enthusiast, the traffic is a small price to pay for unparalleled access to hiking, mountain biking, skiing, snowboarding, fishing, kayaking, or really any other outdoor activity you can think of. North Vancouver has it all. It is a great place to raise a family now, just as it was back when Michelle was growing up there.
As we mentioned in the intro, we spoke to Michelle's sister Tammy and Michelle's daughter Jackie to help us and our audience get to know Michelle and her story. The only information about Michelle Mercer online is the RCMP release about her being missing, as well as an article that was written about Michelle's lifestyle for the magazine Alberta Views that was later featured in Reader's Digest magazine, but we'll get more into those articles later. Unfortunately, as most of us know, if someone is living a certain lifestyle or engaging in behavior that society may deem as risky, their story is often ignored and people shrug their shoulders and move on. We believe this is part of the reason that Michelle's story has not been covered by the media or thoroughly investigated. We're going to start from Michelle's early years growing up in North Vancouver. Here's her sister Tammy with more about their somewhat turbulent upbringing.
So we grew up, there was three children. My mom had me, and then she had twins 13 months later. So you can only imagine how difficult that was in the 60s when there was no disposable diapers and plastic baby bottles and all that, and no nannies and no real assistance. And at the time where we lived in North Vancouver, it was quite rural. So there was no buses or anything. And most of the homes were like a one car family. And most of the mums were stay-at-home mums. And so my mother found that really challenging. And as a result, she had some difficulties with mental health. So throughout our younger years, my mom was in and out of hospitals. There was, you could feel the dysfunction even growing up. You knew something wasn't quite right, but you know how kids are. We just kind of played our way through it. Later in life, my mom was diagnosed, we now call it bipolar, but manic depression, which as a result, she took a lot of pills and then later alcohol. So it's not clear what came first, you know, how it all played out. So that was our early years. So it was a little bit unconventional where it was a little unstable in the home, would be a good way to put it, a little bit turbulent. And my mother wanted to go back to work as soon as she could to basically get away from the kids. And so she did when we were quite young. So when they talk about latchkey kids, we were definitely latchkey kids. We literally had our house key around our neck on a string, not even on a chain, on a string. And although our elementary school was quite close and most kids would go home for lunch, we had lunch kits, which made us different. And we all know how different cannot always be a good thing in school. So we had that to contend with. And then as we moved into our teenage years, my mom was working and everything, but the friction between my dad and mom was like there was a lot of fighting going on in the house. So there was definitely the feeling that you wanted to get out, right? And Michelle's brother, her twin, he actually left the home when he was 15 and moved out. And then Michelle graduated early from high school so that she could leave in January. And she immediately moved out with her then boyfriend. And they got an apartment together. In fact, she got an apartment together with her brother Michael. So there were the three of them in an apartment pretty much out of Michelle's high school.
So both of their parents struggled with alcohol abuse. And as anyone who's experienced an alcoholic parent will understand, it creates a home in which it's pretty difficult for a child to feel safe. Tammy shared with us that her mother arrived at her graduation intoxicated to the point where she was falling out of the car, which I'm sure was really, really tough for Tammy. So Michelle Mercer was a very bright girl and graduated from high school early. She also moved out of the family home as soon as she could and into an apartment in North Vancouver with a boyfriend, but that relationship came to an end pretty quickly after they moved in together. Here's Tammy with more on Michelle's life after she moved out of her parents' house.
And Michelle got a job right away working for I believe it was an insurance agency. Michelle is really bright, smart, gets things really quickly, very pretty, outgoing, like very popular. And instantly likable. And, you know, she was not aggressive, but I'd say assertive in her way of being. Like she knew what she wanted. And when she made up her mind, she didn't want to be in the house anymore. That was it. And so she moved out and she never did move ever back home.
We wanted to get Jackie's perspective on her mother's early life. So here's what Jackie had to say.
Well, to be honest, I only have what she told me, and I don't really have anything from her little years. It was more like her teenage years, and then it was basically, yeah, once she was done in the home, she wasn't really happy there, and yeah, she left, and she moved out and started making her own way, and then her and my dad got married, and she moved to Alberta. When I spoke to my dad, she was underage when they got married. So my grandfather had to sign for her to get married. But they were already living in Alberta at the time. So they went back to Vancouver to get married and then were already living here. And then they were in an apartment. And then after they got married, they purchased a house.
So Jackie skipped ahead a little bit there, but after Michelle and the guy that she moved out with after high school broke up, Michelle and Jackie's dad, Ed, started a relationship. The two had known each other from high school and lived in close proximity to each other. And even though Michelle and Ed knew each other growing up, they didn't begin a romantic relationship until after high school. According to Jackie, she believes that the love between her parents was very strong, but it just wasn't enough. Here's Jackie to explain more on that.
I think they were, like, at the time, both of my parents are a little bit wild, let's be honest. My dad liked fast cars and fast things and doing life on the edge. And I'm pretty sure that was just what reeled my mom right in. Let's go drag race your pickup truck with no lights on so nobody can find us. I'm sure that was appealing to her. It's definitely been a crazy road. This whole journey, my whole life. But I have to say, like, my dad and my mom, like, as we get into this, I'll explain more and it will make more sense. But to this day, both of them still loved each other. My dad couldn't keep her from the partying and the drinking and the drugs and all that. But, you know, I was I'm probably the only kid out there that has divorced parents that neither one of them has ever spoken a bad word about the other.
Jackie and Tammy kept making mention of Michelle being a bit wild and crazy as a young adult. And in the spirit of getting to know Michelle better, we wanted them to elaborate on what they meant by that. Here's Tammy and then Jackie with their thoughts.
I wouldn't say she was wild. Like we weren't bad kids. Like really in the scheme of things, even for the times, like I'm more the goody two shoes for sure. But you know, we did like, okay, there was drugs around, but you know, I didn't do it. I had a horse, so I was like paying for my horse and stuff. So I was in a slightly different place for me, but you know, there wasn't a lot around. Like there was hash, there was pot, there was mushrooms, there was a bit of acid, but Michelle and Michael weren't really heavy duty into that. Like, you know, smoke a little pot maybe at a party and things like that. But there was no dealing and there was no stealing and there was no, like my brother, he went for a joyride in my dad's car one night and got stopped, you know, and stuff like that. But nothing major, nothing major.
She was more not like, she was more just for a good time. Like she always wanted to be having fun. She always wanted to be around people. She just was happy and wanted to be having fun and doing all that stuff. And so, yeah, they were just, yeah, doing that kind of thing.
Okay, just to recap a little bit here. Michelle Mercer graduated from high school a year early and then immediately left the family home to move into an apartment with a boyfriend and her brother, Michael. Michelle and that boyfriend broke up soon after moving in together, but then Michelle started up a relationship with Jackie's father, Ed. The two got married and moved to Grand Prairie, Alberta. Soon after they were married, their only child, Jackie, was born. Here's Jackie with more on what her early life was like with Ed and Michelle.
So my parents were married, and then I was born shortly after. I was born in 1981. I am their only child. I was it. My dad moved here with his best friend at the time originally. And they both went to work in the oil field. They heard, you know, the Alberta way, it's paved with gold. So, they both came out here and started working. And my mom basically came up and then she started working in just a basic office type environment, doing administrative and stuff like it. She wasn't ever doing like the manual labor kind of thing. It was very administrative based. And then, yeah, they had me. And then I don't know, honestly, she wouldn't have worked for the first year. And then I was pretty little to remember much. But I do know, like, when I was, like, the 5-6 age, because my parents split up when I was 2. But my mom was still around Grand Prairie when I was, like, the 5-6 age. And she was definitely working an administration job because I would go to work with her a lot of the time and hang out and stuff like that. It's interesting because in Alberta, it's still very much that way here. Like, I know my son now, when he's not in school, there's many days where I bring him to work with me, too. Like, it's just the way it is up here. It's a whole other life. It's a very different lifestyle here. I would say Grand Prairie, if you came here now, it would be like Vancouver in the 70s and 80s. Like we're still there. So that's kind of here. And yeah, she just stuck to mostly administrative jobs here.
As Jackie just said, her parents ended up getting divorced when she was just 2 years old. We asked what prompted their split.
Truthfully, when I was born, my dad knew like the responsibilities of a child and having that. And my mom still wanted to party and drink and hang out with her friends and do all that. And it basically was just the demise of their marriage. It was just the balance. And she didn't want to settle down into that. And she wanted to keep having fun, but she definitely didn't walk away from me or anything. Like she was still around and she was still in my life. And to be honest, my dad really didn't have a time at, like he had girlfriends after that, but nothing really stuck or was like, he was just working and living. And he didn't actually get into like a solid relationship probably until I was about 8. That was any sort of length of time. Like, yes, he had girlfriends, but, and then my mom, after they split up, she ended up meeting a gentleman by the name of Don Hodges. And he also tried to get her to settle down and stuff. So when she was with Don, like, I was still seeing quite a bit of her.
Michelle didn't really want to settle down, and having Jackie didn't stop her from wanting to have fun and party and be with her friends. Naturally, this led to friction in the relationship and her and Ed split. But Ed, as Jackie just said, did not move on quickly. It took nearly a decade for him to get into any kind of long-term relationship after their divorce, and Jackie was still seeing her mother during this period of their lives. Tammy also wanted to jump in here with her experience with her sister Michelle while she was married and looking after baby Jackie.
Yeah, so for example, I went to see Michelle when Jackie was maybe 5 or 6 months old, maybe, and I arrived sort of to help out idea, and she just saw me as like the instant babysitter so she could go and be with her friends. So I was kind of like, I didn't think that was my role. I thought we were going to spend time together, but that I think just to add on to what Jackie's saying, Michelle didn't really want, it's not that she didn't want to have Jackie, it's just she didn't want to be tied down, which now all these years later was very much like our own mother, like the same, I don't want to be tied down to this. This isn't, you know, I want to live my life.
Now, another factor that may have come into play when it came to the end of Ed and Michelle's relationship was the economic recession of the 1980s. Ed, unfortunately, ended up having to completely walk away from the house that they had purchased for their family in Grand Prairie due to the surging interest rates, and he bought a mobile home instead. Years later, Michelle would end up meeting another man by the name of Don, and the two were set to get married when the unthinkable happened. Now, full disclosure, we were unable to nail down an exact date for when the incident we are about to talk about took place, but we believe it would be safe to say it was likely in the late 1980s. We'll let Jackie explain.
So she was living in Edmonton at the time, and Dawn was here in Grand Prairie working. And she left Edmonton and was coming to Grand Prairie. And we have a small little town not far from here. It's about an hour away, and it's called Valley View. In Valley View, she picked up a hitchhiker. Just outside of Valley View is a Native reservation. And they hitchhike all the time from town to the reserve. And honestly, they still do it. But she had picked up a hitchhiker in Valley View, and on her way to Grand Prairie, she went to turn in at the reserve to go drop this fellow off. And she ended up hitting some sort of a farm truck and got in a vehicle accident. And the gentleman was killed in that accident. So then she ended up going to jail for vehicular manslaughter. And she went to a women's correctional facility just outside of Edmonton. You know, it's one of those things that's really, nobody wanted to talk about it. Nobody wanted to talk to me about it. I was so young. And then obviously we're doing this because she disappeared. But before she disappeared, like, I was young. And so nobody wanted to talk about all these things with me. And so I didn't really know a whole lot. So I had to confirm with my dad. And then, yeah, she got out. She went to what was called a halfway house she did that for a while. And I remember being so mad because I was like 9 at the time. And I was like, well, why can't I just come see you now? Like, I just want to come see you. And she's like, oh, well, you can't yet, you know. So I know she did go right from the correctional facility to this halfway house before she was out on her own. She told me very little about her time in jail, other than when she was there, She said she did take some courses, like she was taking at the time, she was taking like a typing course. And I'm going to go with allegedly because I don't know for sure because I wasn't there with her. But she did say my mom, actually, I'll be honest, our whole family really loves books and reading, myself included, and my auntie Tam, my grandfather, everyone, my mom, like everyone's big readers. So she actually spent her time as a librarian there when she was there.
Now, it was at this point in the call that Graham brought up the fact that people rarely get that much prison time for vehicular manslaughter in Canada. It usually results in a driver's license suspension, monetary fines, and maybe a few months of prison time. Graham asked if there was something particularly egregious about Michelle's accident that resulted in the harsher punishment that was given. Here's what Tammy and Jackie later said.
Well, she also was impaired. Don't forget that, missing that piece. Nobody sort of talks about that piece. She was impaired. And the vehicle that she hit was one of those, when you see those big round bales and they've got kind of wires out the side, Michelle was never a good driver. So a drunk or not, you know, this could have happened. But I'm just saying that in her defense. And it was afternoon or evening. And so when she went around the corner, she misjudged the size of the vehicle. And of course, it hit the passenger side.
It came in and it decapitated him. He was intoxicated. And then I think what, even back then, they were doing tests like for breathalyzers and stuff. And she got really nervous and freaked out. And she also drank a bottle of perfume, which, as we know, is pure alcohol, which after the fact, she freaked out. She drank this bottle of perfume. They did like, so she was, not only was she actually intoxicated when she did it, but she would have raised her blood alcohol a lot further by drinking the perfume because she freaked out.
Michelle didn't share much about her time in prison to Jackie or Tammy. We got the impression that it was too difficult for the family to talk about, so it just kind of wasn't brought up. But here's what Tammy had to say when we asked what she knew about Michelle's time behind bars.
Again, there's a bit of a disconnect between Michelle and I, me being the older sister, a bit more, Michelle would say, you know, goody two shoes, straight lace, whatever. So we got along really well when we were younger, but as we got older and our differences started to be so different, we didn't really see eye to eye on a lot of things. And I think she probably felt like I would judge her. But I do remember writing to her in jail, but I don't have any of those letters anymore or anything. But I remember what Jackie said about the being the librarian, and she did a lot of reading, and she did take advantage of some courses to try and sort of keep her mind, because she's super smart too, right? So can imagine the numbing effect of being in a place like that. So she would have tried anything to keep herself kind of stimulated.
Once Michelle was released from prison, she moved into that halfway house. From there, she wrote her daughter Jackie a letter, which Jackie shared with us.
I'll read you the letter that I have from her from just after her release. So you'll kind of get a better feeling of where she was at mentally, emotionally, all of that. So this is dated April of 1991. So she just says, "Dear Jackie, thank you very much for the card. Too bad I don't have a cute one to send back, but it's the thought that counts. I've enclosed a few cute things I've picked up from the shop. I hope everything is going okay for you. I love and miss you. I'm sorry for being kind of out of touch the last year, but I hope I can make it up to you. Someday, maybe we'll talk about it. Just trying to get my life back together. Work is going good. I love my job. I only wish I could see you more. When I get ahead, I will come up and see you. I will talk to Vicky and see if I can stay there. Don says hi. He has to go back to Ontario to see his dad. He's going to have an operation and might not live. Pretty sad. It's sad when your mom and dad dies, no matter how old you are. I hope school is going okay. What are you doing for the summer? We would like to come down fishing. Would you like to join us? In fact, we are planning a trip to two lakes this summer. Maybe you would like to come. We'll talk. I love you. Be strong, Mom." So when she initially got out, Dawn did come back on the scene, and she was going to try to build her life. And when she came out, she was working at a drugstore at the time, like a pharmacy. And so they had, like, you know, pharmacies have knickknacks and stuff. And so she would send me little things in parcels and stuff. But yeah, at that point, when she first came out, she was trying and she was going to do it. And I think, again, Dawn was going to try and save her this time and say, okay, like, we're going to do this. And she got the job and she was doing well.
Things seemed like they were looking up for Michelle after she was released from prison, and from the sounds of things in her letter to Jackie, she was ultimately trying to rebuild her life after making a very bad decision that resulted in the loss of a man's life. Unfortunately, we have no way of truly knowing how much this incident weighed on Michelle, but we do know that this accident forever changed the trajectory of Michelle Mercer's life.
We wanted to get Tammy and Jackie's perspective on how Michelle's life changed after the accident and her time in prison. And here's what they had to say.
I feel, and I don't know because I wasn't there, obviously, 100% of the time, but I feel that as soon as my mom started drinking again after jail, it's her drinking that leads to the more, that brings on the more. So people saying marijuana is a gateway drug, for my mom, it was the alcohol. And that was what happened. And then basically the cycle started all over again. She started drinking and then it's the smoking weed and all of that. And then Don's just like,
I'm out. I can't do it. He cashed in everything he had to pay for her lawyers and everything, including RSPs and everything. And I know because I went and visited them afterwards. And I still have a picture in my hallway of Michelle and I together at their apartment. And, he tried everything, but, you know, we all know what addiction is. It doesn't matter whether it's alcohol, drugs, porn, whatever, you know, addicted is addicted is addicted, right?
People who have loved someone struggling with addiction will understand exactly what Jackie and Tammy just shared. You might want the best for your loved one, and they even may want the best for themselves, but you can't control their actions. This harsh reality unfortunately led Dawn to leaving Michelle's life. Jackie is now going to walk us through what she believes is the series of unfortunate events that led to Michelle living on the streets of Edmonton.
Okay, so basically, I would say once she started back drinking and her and Dawn went their separate ways once and for all kind of thing, at that point in her life, I would say the only people in our family that really had contact were myself and my grandfather. So once she separated from Dawn, she kind of started spiraling and she worked quite often, off and on, for a company out of Edmonton called Labor Ready. What Labor Ready is basically it's cash paid jobs daily. So you have to just think of the demographic of people that type of job is. So when she kind of was falling off and like getting out of it, and then she got into this Labor Ready, this is where she met basically the last people that were involved in her life, like spouse-wise or relationship-wise. She ended up with a gentleman by the name of Joey Sands. And this guy, I believe with all my heart, was her true demise. She met this gentleman, and I'm sure you're going to edit this. So to say it like nicely, he was a piece of shit and he was awful. He was an awful human being, not just in general, but to her, to anybody. He was very, very controlling. And he really did try to control her. And in the end, I think he just kept her drunk, honestly, and high so that he could do whatever he wanted. And she would just, you know, go along with it. And she was just so placid because she was so drunk. So once I was old enough to ride the Greyhound bus, I started going to Edmonton probably every couple of months. And at that point was when her and Joey, they had rented this little house in Edmonton. And my mom was working at a Safeway just down the road. Because after the accident, my mom never, ever drove again. She was far too fearful. She just wouldn't do it. So she was working at a Safeway that was in close proximity to the house. So she was just like a cashier there. And to be honest, I don't remember what Joey did. Just because he was such a hateful person, I feel like my brain has protected itself with a lot of the stuff from him. Like, they were growing pot. They were doing everything. Like, I would go there and, like, they would have a plastic Safeway bag full of pot. And they were smoking it like they would smoke a cigarette. And then on top of that, they were drinking. And Joey wasn't the nice drunk. He was the violent drunk. I will tell you a story here. I don't think nobody in my family has ever heard this because it's just one of those things. I went down to visit and my friend was with me. We rode the Greyhound. We went to go visit. And my mom and Joey had been drinking. And I said something about needing to call my dad or something to let him know I was okay and that I had made it. And then Joey made an offhand comment about my dad. And at that time, they were so drunk and so high. And when Joey made the comment about my dad, my mom lost it. And she went after Joey. And then he like pushed her and everything and was chasing her and like trying to beat her. My friend and I went into the room. We locked ourselves in there. And then I could hear him, like Joey, getting like that fear. I could hear fear in his voice. So I went out of the room and my mom had finally, she had grabbed a knife and she had it to his throat and she was starting to cut his throat because she was so mad at him because he was attacking her and he had said all this stuff about my dad. And I had to grab my mom and grab the knife. And all I remember is just going, please, no, don't do this again. I can't have you go to jail again. And I stopped her from killing him at that point. And somebody had called the police because they had heard this outside, I'm guessing, because it was very violent and very loud. They called the police. And when the police came, they just pretended like nothing had happened. And my friend and I were there. And all I can remember thinking is, I can't say anything because Joey could come after me or my friend or my mom. But it was just, all I remember thinking is, can they just pull me aside by myself? Like, take us kids and ask us what happened. And the police never did. Then the rest of like the days, we just had to like, my friend and I just basically lived in fear of this was going to happen again. And Joey was just, he finally got so mad and the police said, well, I don't think you should stay here tonight. So then he took off and then it was just like mom and my friend and I, and we locked all the doors and put chairs and stuff in front of them. And my mom slept on the couch with a knife she would have, there's no question in my mind, she would have killed him if he came through that door again. As much like, I don't know what happened when I wasn't there, but I can't imagine it was any better than what I got to witness. And then my mom, all of the children, my auntie and my uncle and my mom, their great aunt passed away and they all received an inheritance. And my mom was terrified that Joey was just going to take this money and do whatever. So she was trying to hide it and everything. And it ended up, he started spending it. Like, he went and bought a car and then he bought a TV and she couldn't stop him. And she had money like hidden in her house. The final of it was, is she came home and Joey had taken the car, packed it with everything in the house. He had stolen all of her jewelry, everything she had, her identification. He took my birth certificate. He took everything from her and left her. He absolutely took it all. And she was broken. She was just done. And I believe after that, she went back to doing the jobs, but she couldn't afford to stay in the house anymore. So she got kicked out of that. And then it just spiraled and went right downhill from there. And I believe that was how basically it came to her living on the streets. The interesting thing about her living on the streets was none of us knew. So she was still calling us like every 6 months to check in. And none of us were any the wiser. She never said anything. We didn't know how bad she was until my last phone call with her.
We recognize that some people listening to this episode may question Michelle's decisions, attributing her current situation to her own choices. However, it's essential to understand the powerful grip that addiction can have, driving people into behaviors that they wouldn't typically engage in. This includes forming relationships with people they may otherwise avoid, especially if those people facilitate continued substance use or engage in coercive control and different types of power dynamics. It also really highlights how quickly someone who is living on the edge of poverty can have a series of events occur, like having someone rob them, and all of a sudden they don't have the money to keep a shelter above their head.
This particular episode hits home for me, as I can relate to both Jackie and Tammy, as I myself have loved someone who struggles with addiction, more specifically, alcoholism. It's a pain I would not wish on anyone, and anyone who's listening who can relate knows what it's like to come to the very difficult realization that you can't fix or control the person living with addiction. Sometimes the only thing you can do is remove yourself from the situation and focus on taking care of you. Some people have to go completely no contact or at least limited contact to make their own lives bearable. Here's Jackie with more.
It was hard talking to her once I was older because she would just always look at me. And as a child, to have your parent look at you and go, you know what? One day when I grow up, I won't be like you. So my mom telling me that when she grew up, she wanted to be like me was, you know, hard. And you know, just like Auntie Tam had said about her mother at her graduation. So that was the last time that I physically laid my eyes on my mom was she came to my graduation and she was so high and drunk. She missed the whole thing. And all she did was walk around and say, hi, do you know Jackie Davis? Do you know Jackie Davis? I'm her mom. I'm her mom. And she wasn't part of my life and she wasn't here. So I had so many people come up to me and be like, there's some lady going around and she's drunk and she's asking. I'm like, oh my God. Yeah, that is my mom. It was, I think the disheartening part for me was it was my graduation. And instead of saying like, Jackie, against all the odds against you, you graduated. Like, I'm so proud of you. Her big thing was, wow, Jackie, you are so popular. Everybody knows you.
Due to Michelle's lifestyle and somewhat secretive, independent nature, the family usually only spoke to her a handful of times a year and saw her sporadically. So when Jackie saw her mother at her graduation in Grand Prairie in the year 2000, it came as a massive shock to see how much her mother had declined. Jackie let us know that at that point, Michelle had moved on to harder drugs and there was physical evidence of that. We asked Tammy what she remembers about the last time she saw Michelle.
But back to what we were talking about, 2000, when she just appeared out of nowhere, I happened to be visiting my dad and Jeanette in North Vancouver. By that time, I'm living on the island and I'm on my way to a wedding. So I stopped at Jeanette and Dad's place and Michelle just showed up and it was like a shock. Like I was shocked to see her looking that bad. Because Michelle normally would take really good care of herself, you know, and I had been protected because now I'm on the island. I don't know about all this that's going on. And my dad was not one to air dirty laundry, so to speak. So he didn't really want to tell me what was going on. So I was oblivious and he would just say things to me like, have you heard from your sister? And I'd be like, oh, no, not for a long time. And he'd be like, oh, okay. So as we move further about when she went missing, that's why it took us so long to realize she was missing.
Obviously, it was very concerning to see Michelle like this. But what the family did not really know or comprehend was that Michelle's life had hit rock bottom. In Edmonton, she was living with no fixed address, and she was scraping by collecting bottles and cans and returning them to a bottle depot. Michelle was living in the Strathcona area of Edmonton, and according to Jackie, Michelle was not taking advantage of any government or city help. She was not collecting any sort of social assistance checks or accessing services. This, of course, made her movements even more difficult to track, as there was no way of knowing whether she picked up her last check or cashed it even. An interesting part of Michelle's story happened in 2005 or 2006, when Michelle and her partner at the time, Roy, were featured in an article that was titled "The Gleaners: Salvaging a Living from What Others Discard, Bottle Pickers Make the Most of Our Disposable Culture." This article was originally published by the Alberta Views magazine in July of 2005, but was picked up by Reader's Digest for their November 2006 issue. The contents of this Gleaners article, this Reader's Digest article, were actually quite shocking to the family members, who actually didn't know how bad things had gotten for Michelle. So we'll let Jackie take the floor on how she found out about the Gleaners article and what her reaction to it was.
So this is what happened. We may as well just dive into on how this crazy roller coaster I was on happened. So I spoke with my mom 2 weeks before she went missing, and her and I were talking, and she was really upset, and she knew, like, she was in trouble at that point. She knew her life wasn't going to last. She was scared. She said that she was bleeding out. And I had said to her, "Have you gone to the doctor?" And she said, "No, I'm too scared to go to the doctor because of what they might say." And I said, "Well, Mom, if you're bleeding out and it's coming out of your body, you either have internal damage somewhere or something else is happening bigger. I'm like, you need to sort it out." And she's like, no, I'm too scared. I'm like, well, you have to deal with it. Like, this is an option at this time. But she was terrified. So at that point, I said to her, I said, "Okay." I said, "You're not well." And I said, "You need help." And she said, and she just kept saying, I'm too scared. And at that point, I was going through a lot of health issues myself. I have a rare form of migraine that I actually have what's called TIAs, which are mini strokes. Through all of the medical stuff that I had to go through, everyone had to finally just be straight with me and admit that my mom had drank when she was pregnant with me. Because the doctors just couldn't figure out why things were happening and everything. So when my mom said, "Oh, Grandma says you're sick." And then it was just instinctive. I was trying to scare her to help herself. And I said, "Yeah, I'm sick." And I said, "And you did this." I was like, "You did this to me when you were pregnant." And I said, "You can't help me now." I said, "But you need to help yourself." I said, "You need to do something." And she just said, I'm too scared. And I said to her, I said, "What do you need?" I said, "Do you want me to come there?" I was like, "Do you want me to come? I'll take you. I'll go through treatment with you. I'll take you to the doctors. I'll do whatever you want." Because at that point, I was in my 20s, but I was old enough at that point to kind of be like, take the bull by the horns and maybe actually help her and do something. She's like, no, I don't want you to come. And I'm like, we kind of got into a bit of an argument. And I said, "No, I'm like, you're not okay. You did this to me. Now you're doing this to you. You need help. Let me help you." And she would not take it. She would not take it. And I mean, now I have to live with the fact that my very last phone call with my mother was yelling at her and telling her that she needed help and making her cry and all that. But at the time in my 20s, like, I was just like, oh, just like, come on, like, do something, help yourself. And she wouldn't do it, but she was terrified that she was going to die. So because I was having so many medical issues, I was at the doctor's one day, and this was after she had gone missing. So she had gone missing, and then I was sitting in the doctor's office, and as most doctor's office do, you sit there and they have all the crappy magazines everywhere. So I just picked up, literally just picked up a Reader's Digest, and I started flipping through, and I almost vomited because I'm flipping through this Reader's Digest and I find a picture of my mother sitting in a shack, like by the railroad tracks, basically. And my heart sunk and I was like, I'm going to throw up. So I went into the doctor's office. Like they called me in and I still had the Reader's Digest. And it literally says, for your reading pleasure, do not remove from the room. I said to the doctor, I'm like, she just looks at me and I was pale. And she's like, are you okay? I'm like, no, I'm not okay. And she's like, what's wrong, dear? And I was like, can I have this? And she's like, sure, but why? And I'm like, I flip it open and I said, this is my mom. I just found out she's living on the streets. And she's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I don't even know how to process this right now. I'm like, I don't know what to do. I was like, but I need to keep this. And she's like, absolutely. So I kept it, obviously.
We honestly can't imagine what it was like for Jackie to pick up a magazine in a doctor's office, as one does, and flipping through the pages only to come across a photo of your mother who has been reported missing. Not only that, but the shock at seeing for the first time the living conditions that Michelle had been enduring. We're now going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors, and when we return, we will talk more about the Gleaners article, as well as the details surrounding Michelle's disappearance, the investigation, and the theories.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And we are back. So we're now going to read part of the Gleaner's article for you. I'd been introduced to Michelle and Roy at the Strathcona Bottle Depot 2 weeks before. The manager of the Bottle Depot had agreed to do an interview about the ins and outs of depot operations and had graciously granted me access to his staff. One of his employees, Jessie, a 53-year-old woman, was the person to whom I'd first floated the idea of an article about bottle pickers. I set up a breakfast meeting with Roy and Michelle for a couple of weekends later at the A&W on White Avenue. When I order my coffee and walk to a booth by the windows, Roy and Michelle come in the side door, leaving a single green garbage bag just inside the entrance. The weather broke the day before, and they look relaxed. Michelle's pink coat is as mottled with stains as the bearded man's hands, and Roy has his ball cap pulled down so his eyes are barely visible. Michelle immediately goes to check the trash bins inside the store. Michelle smiles when she sees me, and I order them bacon and eggs. Michelle Mercer was born on Salt Spring Island 44 years ago. This is at least what she tells me at A&W. She also says she's Métis. She lived in Vancouver before moving to Alberta in 1982, where she first worked at a few sour gas plants. And then she got married to an oil patch boy. That didn't last, and she got married again. Now she's with Roy. Roy Gillibrand is a little more guarded about his past. He's 48 and was born in Montreal. He came to Alberta in 1987. He delivered truck parts for a while, and he's divorced. They both finished high school. So how did you meet, and what got you started on bottle picking? We met through Labor Ready, says Michelle, 8 years ago. This is the agency that pays cash for a day's labor, right? That's them, says Roy. We only started traveling around together about a year ago, though. She was the wife of my best friend. This is the second guy? I ask Michelle. Nope, another guy, she says. I have a knack for attracting men. Hopefully, says Roy, smiling, that's changed. Bottle picking, originally, was just a supplement to their other income. Both claim Labor Ready paid fairly well, over $8 an hour, but not enough to keep an apartment. Eventually, when they figured out the taxes and other deductions coming off their checks, they realized bottles might actually pay more. And while they still take odd jobs, they make sure they do their route before anything else. The talk turns to the nitty-gritty as breakfast arrives. What do you make in a day? Between 20 and 50, but it used to be higher. How far is your route? It's not always the same. Some days we do 15 miles. What are the pitfalls? Hornets in the summer and falling bin lids year-round. What are the worst things about it? Kitty litter and diapers. I'm following Roy and Michelle along the edge of the Strathcona rail yards. We turn down an alley partially lined with used tires piled 5 or 6 high and come to a single remaining house on the block. It's one of the perfectly square ones, almost identical, that were originally built south of White for the Gainers employees who worked at the former packing plant along Mill Creek. Roy avoids the main house, stepping between a rusting streamlined trailer and piles of tires. He stops at what I think is a garage. It's actually an old chicken coop, Roy says. The guy who owns the house used to keep chickens years ago. We built our place along the side. Roy pulls away a metal brace that's keeping the door to the shack shut. There's too much ice and snow against it to open it more than a few inches. I manage to squeeze inside. It's more brightly lit than I expected. A high workbench runs along the entry wall with unopened tins of vegetables, Tetra Paks, and prepackaged expired sandwiches found in dumpsters. There's a small bottle of fuel. In the middle of the room is the vinyl back seat from a car. In front of it is a cluttered knee-high table with an ashtray. Just to the left of the door is the bed, a double foamy with bed sheets and a comforter. Roy and Michelle prefer sheets that they wash every couple of weeks, unlike others who keep the same sleeping bag for months on end. There's no heat or electricity, no water, and no toilet. Michelle confides that they relieve themselves in pots and then just walk to any of the nearby vacant lots or through the various mazes of tires to dump them out. On really cold nights, 40 below, they snuggle in bed, hang blankets around that part of the hut, and light a torch or propane heater to warm the draped-off area. They have candles from Army and Navy and read by candlelight. Michelle sleeps with her bottled water in bed, otherwise she says it freezes solid and there's no place to get water at 2 a.m. They have a radio, but the battery-powered TV they scavenge only worked for about 10 minutes before it died. Do you have any idea why you do this? I ask. It's a stupid question, and obviously leading. Hey, we're recycling, says Michelle. We're helping the planet, ourselves, we're staying fit, we're out there in the fresh air, we're our own bosses, we get to see a lot of people and a lot of things. People come home, Roy goes on, and they bitch. They bitch about jobs or school. They bitch at each other. We try to stay happy.
There are some inaccuracies in the article, and it seems that both Roy and Michelle made a few things up, most likely to keep their identities more opaque. Notably, Michelle was not born on Salt Spring Island, and we have not been able to verify any Métis heritage. Tammy expressed to us that she was initially unhappy with the article that had been written about her sister's life. She felt that the writer had tried to glamorize life on the streets as some sort of moral choice based on living a zero-waste lifestyle, when in reality, there was absolutely nothing glamorous about Michelle's circumstances. She was living in a chicken coop in downtown Edmonton, sleeping with freezing water bottles, and a man with a questionable character. This is not safe for a variety of reasons. Jackie mentioned that Michelle had told her that she was fearful about her health declining and that she had unexplained bleeding coming from her vagina. Jackie, of course, begged her mother to see a doctor, but out of fear, Michelle refused. It was about 2 weeks after this phone call that the family would get word that Michelle was missing. We asked Jackie if Michelle had ever mentioned being fearful of others. Here's Jackie.
So this is something I had to tell the police too, and like I said, anything with somebody who's an addict or an alcoholic or has any sort of abuse problems, I don't know how true it was, but she said that at some point she had testified against some guy. And she had said that this man basically told her, because my mom testifying against him got him put into jail. She basically said, if he ever gets out, he's going to come kill me. So she did have that. But I think at that point, my last conversation with her was she was more fearful that the alcohol, the drugs, the years of hard were catching up to her body. And she just knew that her body was going to give out. And she was just like, I don't feel well.
In the weeks and months before her disappearance, Michelle faced several challenges. Her health appeared to be deteriorating, and there were concerns that someone may have wanted her dead. This was due to Michelle allegedly being a key witness whose testimony led to someone being incarcerated. We wanted to know more about Michelle's circumstances in the immediate time frame before she disappeared. We know that Michelle was partnered up and living with Roy, but here's Tammy and Jackie with more on that.
At the time that she went missing, she was no longer living on the streets. She and Roy had built quite a repertoire relationship, like with her little community of people, but also the manager of the Bottle Depot, oddly enough. So the manager of the Bottle Depot had actually rented them a bedroom in his home in the basement. And so when we were continuing to talk, she was calling me from his house. So at no point did any of us know, because she was still talking to me at least twice a year, and without fail, never in all my years until she went missing did she ever miss calling me on my birthday. Like, even when she was in jail, she still called me. Like, I never missed phone calls from her on my birthday. So we really had no idea. But at that point when she went missing, she wasn't living on the streets anymore.
Michelle Mercer was officially reported missing on February 7th, 2006 by the man she had been living with, Roy Gillibrand. He says he last saw her the previous day, February 6th. So to be clear, the Gleaner's article was published in 2005 originally in the Alberta Views magazine, and then Reader's Digest published it in November of 2006. Michelle went missing in February of 2006, but Jackie didn't see the article in the Reader's Digest until after her mother had gone missing. Now, due to Michelle's lifestyle and the fact that she had no fixed address, we understand that this timeline isn't very easy to follow. Not only that, but police weren't quick to react when Roy reported her missing. In fact, it took days for police to finally reach out to Michelle's family members to ask if anyone had heard from her. Here's Jackie and Tammy with more on how they found out Michelle was missing.
Okay, so we were the first to know. I was living with my grandparents, and the police phoned the house. And it was the Edmonton police. And they basically told us that Roy, it wasn't right away. I think they called us like almost 3 or 4 days later, that they called us and said, Roy Gillibrand has said that he is claiming Michelle is missing. My grandpa and I both at the time were like, if he's saying she's missing, she's missing. I don't get any bad thing from Roy. He's just there like, do, 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 do. I honestly don't believe Roy would hurt my mom or do anything. She made me speak to him all the time on the phone. Like, they would call me and, I don't want to talk to Roy, but okay. So at that point I was like, if Roy's saying she's missing, she's missing. And then we did talk to Roy, and Roy at the time had said, basically the story I got from him was, so they were out with their little group of friends and they were all drinking or whatever. And because they weren't living on the streets anymore, Roy was basically like, hey, Michelle, I think you've had enough. Like, we're good. I think it's time to go home now. And she basically was like, no, I'm not done. It's not enough for me. And I don't want to go home. And he's like, no, you need to go. Like, let's go. And then they got into an argument, and then she walked away, and that was it. And she was never to be seen again. And then he tried to report her missing like the next day kind of thing. And the police, just given their status, wouldn't really take it seriously, right? So he was persistent enough. So thank goodness that Roy was persistent enough that he did keep going back, because then after like the third, fourth day was when they called us, in Vancouver. And then we're like, no, if he says this is happening, then this is actually happening.
I found out when like Jackie says, when my dad was contacted by the police, then my dad phoned me, and at first I was like, well, it's got to be the boyfriend, right? It's obvious. Always the boyfriend. But then I spoke with him and he said a couple things. And I mean, keep in mind, this is a long time ago, so I'm going on real distant memories. But one thing really stuck out for me, and this is really random, but Jackie will get it. He said, Michelle would never, because the police were trying to say maybe she just wants to disappear and doesn't want to be found. And he said to me, she would never leave without her contacts. She can't see without her contacts. So she can't see. And she'd always say, my eyes, I need my eyes. He said she would never leave. Like of all things, she might leave her purse. She might, but she would never leave without her contacts. So he says, I don't believe she left of her own accord.
So all they really know was that Michelle had been out drinking with a group of friends and Roy on the evening of February 6, 2006. And Roy told her that it was time to go home and that she'd had enough. Michelle reacted negatively to this and allegedly walked off to never be seen again. Roy reported Michelle missing the very next day when she failed to return to where they were living, but according to Roy, police didn't take his report seriously due to their lifestyle. Luckily, Roy kept returning to the police daily and was persistent. This finally led to law enforcement to start doing some legwork and contacting Michelle's family. We had some questions regarding the last night that Michelle had been seen. First, we asked if police had questioned the group of people that Michelle had been drinking with that night.
Yes, they have spoken with them. They did talk to everyone that she was partying with, and nobody saw anything. She really did just disappear.
Then we wanted to know where exactly in Edmonton they were partying together on the night she went missing.
Yeah, they were downtown Edmonton. I want to believe I might be accurate enough to say it was on White Ave, it's called. That was kind of the street that my mom hung out on, even when she wasn't homeless. There's like billiards places and all sorts of stuff. It's kind of like, yeah. So White Ave is where I believe they were hanging out.
Now, I'll be the first to admit that neither Graham or I are familiar with Edmonton, having never been there ourselves, but I did ask a friend of mine who lives in Edmonton if he could give me a rough overview of White Ave, and he said it's a pretty lively area, definitely where the party's at, lots of shops, restaurants, some dingier pubs, and back in the mid-2000s, there were loony and toony nights, so it was relatively cheap to go out and have a good time. We asked if any searches had been done in the White Ave area or where Michelle was last seen.
No, I think given, like I said, it's so sad, but given her status, the best thing they did was call the family to say she's missing. And we said, okay, if they say she's missing, she's actually missing. But truth be told, no searches were ever done.
So no official searches were ever done for Michelle Mercer, but what police did do was take DNA from both Michelle's father and Michelle's twin brother, Michael, to have on file in the event that unidentified remains were ever recovered so they could test them against Michelle's DNA. We wanted to know what the police have told the family over the years.
Because when I talked to Constable Begin, I could get that wrong, but I think it was Begin. He told me initially that he thought maybe she just didn't want to be found. And I'm like, that's not jiving for me. And then in later conversations, he said, we believe something untoward has happened to your sister. And then I said, so now what? And he's basically like how Jackie said, they just didn't care. It was like one last person off the street, big deal, right? And life chucks on. And they just didn't care. And they did so much as to get the DNA and said, if we ever find a body, you know, and that's pretty sad. But I mean, I'm glad they did it now because my dad's gone now. And, you know, he, of course, left without knowing whatever happened to his daughter. And here we are all these years later. And that's why I just thought it's been enough time that maybe there were people in that world that are now out of that world that have got their life together and they remember something or they know something.
We think that it's certainly notable that the police did let the family know that they believe something untoward has happened to Michelle to cause her disappearance. Whether they have evidence to support that or they just reached that conclusion based on street rumors or remains not being found is something only the police know. There was, however, a rumor that Michelle's shopping cart had been found overturned on a street or in a ditch. However, this has not been corroborated by investigators or the family. None of Michelle's belongings have been found or positively identified. And if you've ever spent time on the streets of a modern city, you will know that it's almost impossible to identify belongings in a sea of discarded clothing, shopping carts, and general refuse. We did reach out to the Edmonton Police Service for a statement on this case. Unfortunately, we were unable to get their comments before recording this episode. We will include any comments from them on our social media. We do want to add that the officers that we spoke to were super accommodating with us. Jackie is taking things a step further and will be reaching out to the Edmonton Police Service for all of the information surrounding her mother's file.
So I'm on a mission now to get my birth certificate, and I'm hoping, to be honest, I want her entire police file. I want it all. I want her jail. I want every misdemeanor. I want her missing case. I want it all because at the end of the day, I mean, I said to my aunt, at the end of the day, she has a grandson and he's 9. And sorry, it's really hard because he asks me questions all the time why he doesn't have a grandma and where his grandma is. And, you know, it's really hard. It's really hard. And one day he is going to look for answers. And I want to be the one to give them to him. But right now it's, you know, it's hard for me to tell him these things because it's such a big thing for a kid to try and understand. And, you know, it was kind of funny actually in kindergarten. He had it worked in his head that his grandma was a spy and she died saving people in a volcano. So he just like, he just made things up, and it just really hurts him that he doesn't have a grandma.
It was time to ask Tammy and Jackie what they thought may have happened to Michelle. Did they lean towards a natural or accidental death as Michelle's health seemed to be deteriorating, or did they side with law enforcement and believe that Michelle was a victim of foul play?
I'll tell you my personal thoughts and feelings. So when I got the call that my mom was missing, it wasn't the first time that she had gone missing. So it was the first time, though, that I knew she wasn't coming back. I instantly knew and felt this is different. She's gone. I don't know. It was just such a weird feeling that I was like, this is it. She's gone now. And so I don't know how much you guys believe in the afterlife and all that stuff. So I contacted this medium, and she does a lot of work with the Edmonton police. So I made an appointment to go see her and talk to her. And she just like, she opened the door and she's like, whoa, she's like, you have a lot of presence. And I was like, okay. And I didn't tell her anything. I never said a word about what I wanted out of the session or anything. I never brought a picture, nothing. And the what she told me was just, she said there was a woman that wore purple. And I'm like, it's my mom. That was her favorite color, was purple. It's been strange. I've had dreams about my mom, and it's always the same, that she's dead and she's laying in a forest. And the forest up here in Alberta is lots of poplar trees, like, so that white kind of bark and really tall, right? And narrow. And I always have this dream that I'm like laying down and looking up, and that's the type of trees I can see. And I never said a word to this lady. And yeah, she said basically that is what happened. And that's where my mom is. So she's in a wooded area and that she probably will never be found. So she basically told me that the woman was picked up off the streets and murdered.
Jackie definitely believes that her mother is deceased, and she immediately suspected right from the start that her life had been taken from her by someone else. We then asked Tammy what she had heard and what her theories about her sister's disappearance are.
I've heard nothing, and some of the stuff I've heard today from Jackie's the first time I've heard some of it. And again, in our family, it's like all families, nobody talks sometimes about things that are tough, right? It's not, and I'm so glad now, Jackie, that this has spurred you on to get the files and everything. And I just felt this, anyways, back to your question, Graham, sorry. I'm much like Jackie. I think somebody grabbed her. Michelle was a bit of a spitfire. And if you crossed her, like when she went after Joey, yeah, like she would do it. So if someone threatened her or made a comment, she'd be quick to go up yours and go at them. And especially if she had had a couple of drinks to give her liquid courage. And maybe something went wrong, altercation, banged her head, and then someone threw her in a dumpster or something. That was my thinking. And then she would just end up in a landfill. And that, but now what Jackie's saying about going to the medium, I don't have any other than that, Graham. That was my thinking. Something happened, whether it was by accident or because of an altercation. I didn't feel like she got targeted, like I'm going to kill Michelle. I think she could have got mouthy with somebody and somebody got into it with her and then she got killed and then they just hauled her. That's what I think. Got thrown into a dumpster and that was the end of it.
So both Tammy and Jackie believe foul play was involved here. We also think that this is the most likely scenario. Even though Michelle was not in the best of health, if she had succumbed to her ongoing health issues, we believe her body likely would have been located. The same goes for suicide or any kind of accidental death. People can't hide their own body.
Michelle's family has endured many years without answers of any kind. They don't have a full picture of what happened on February 6, 2006. There's a lot about Michelle's life post-2000 that is unknown. We asked Tammy how her sister's disappearance has impacted her life.
Full disclosure, I initially was like, and I've changed a lot since then, but I was kind of like, well, Michelle, geez, you know, you lead this life, like we try to help and you basically give us the middle finger. And now now we're in this situation. So I was kind of, I'll say angry at her, you know, and a bit of, what's the word? I couldn't get my head around it. I just can't get my head around it. Like how you could allow this to get to this point. Like I just couldn't wrap my head around when I read these articles. I'm like, that can't be my sister. That cannot be my sister. And then I got to the point of feeling like when I talked to the police and the outreach worker, her name was Terry Kettleson. I've got my notes here. And I sort of then learned more about her life. And it was like, this is real. This is really my sister. Like, I can't fool myself anymore. This is really my sister, and she's probably gone, and nobody will help us. Like, we didn't push probably hard enough, but when you're a province away and you're so out of your element, I'm so out of my element that I didn't know what to ask. I didn't know who to ask. You know, what do you mean there's a shopping cart? What do you mean she lives in a chicken coop? Like, I was just so removed. And then, yeah. And then in the years since, through age, obviously, and seeing how the world is going, I have a better understanding. And I think too, I've done, like Jackie's done therapy, me too. I also wrote about my mother in an anthology to kind of, that helps cleanse it out too. I don't know. I don't know if I'm getting to the right answer. How does it feel for me? How it's impacted my life? I think by doing this, by reaching out to you, it's one of those things where it's always in the back of my head. And I talked about my sister in the present because we don't really have answers. But then I'd say, she's probably not here, but we don't have a body and we don't have closure. So I talk about her in the present, but in myself, I'm thinking she's not here. And when I started listening to your podcast and listening, and at the end, you always say, you know, if you have story ideas, especially if you are part of the family, and I'm like, damn it, maybe we can resurrect this because nobody cares. Nobody cares. All these years later, nobody cares. And I just think somebody has to have seen something. And maybe this will be the way to do it. And so I just decided that really, I was nervous to do it because I thought I'm going to get shut down. They're going to say, no, that's too old or not exciting enough. And I thought, nothing ventured, nothing gained, Tammy. Put your writing skills to work and do it. So here we are. And thank you for entertaining the idea. The one thing I would say, Caitlin and Graham, is for me, I never, ever drink and drive, and I will never, ever let anyone around me drink and drive. And when people get kind of like, why are you like that? I tell them Michelle's story, and I'm like, that could happen to you. So it's just not worth it. It's just not worth it. You know, there's a bright, beautiful woman who has everything in front of her, and in an instant, one bad decision changed the whole direction of her life. And I believe that that was the pivotal moment in her life. I think if that accident had not happened, sure, she might have partied and this and that, but she would not have ended up on the street as a homeless person.
Here's Jackie with how the loss of her mother has impacted her.
It's impacted my life a lot because she was my mom. And it's such a person of influence in people's lives. My mom has always impacted my life, dead or alive. She's just always impacted my life from how I was going to conduct myself, how I said. I think one of the scariest things for me was when I was like, okay, I think I want to have a kid. And then I was like, do I even know how to be a mom? Do I know what that's like? And am I going to fall into the same patterns? I think that is and was my biggest fear. Am I going to be an alcoholic? Am I going to be a good mom? Am I going to, because I didn't have anything to draw from, you know, I still live it, but I never got to ask a lot of the questions I wish I could have asked her. I wish I would have been able to have that talk that she talked about in 91 and said, and we could have sat down and just, she could have told me everything.
This episode is obviously different in many ways from other episodes we have done. One of those differences is there's not a whole lot of calls to actions for our listeners to be able to help Michelle's family. But that doesn't mean you can't take anything away from this episode or from Michelle's story. Here's Jackie's response to us asking how our listeners can help.
For me, I think, I don't know if anyone can help my mom's case, but I want them, if they have a family member in their life, me being young and begging my mom to go get help, if this was now, I was dealing with this and I was in my 30s or 40s, I probably would have even drug her by her hair into my vehicle and forced her to do it. I know they probably think at the time they're not really affecting anyone but themselves, but they are. You know, it's your family that are having to live with your choices. But I think if anyone was going to get anything, I would definitely want them to say like, hey, you know, Johnny over here needs help. If you're in the position to do it, kicking or screaming, you need to take them and get them the help, whether they want it or not. I wish somebody would have gone and got my mom and chained her to a bed in a treatment facility. And then, honestly, if she was to walk in my front door right now, I would be like, you're just going to stay with me. You're just going to live here. We're just going to deal with this. So I think that would be the big thing is like, if you see or have somebody that you're close to, even if you're not family, if it's your best friend or whoever, I would definitely want you to be like, you know what? You don't have an option. You need to get help.
And of course, we asked Tammy the same question.
Much like Jackie, I would say that I'm not sure people can really help unless they happen to have been in and around that area at that time and saw something or knew who she hung out with. Then maybe, like I've said before, someone knows something. But much like Jackie would say, I'm a little bit different maybe, but a lot of people throw the word enabling around. And there's a fine line, and I'm sure that, Graham, you know that if you work in that world, that it's hard to know when you're enabling, when you're, you know, when you're helping. And I think just being there, just have some compassion for people. And it's hard to watch somebody that you love sort of throw their life down the drain. And I've watched too many of my friends do that, right? And family members. So I think have compassion, be there, listen, and support when you can. And for God's sakes, don't drink and drive.
She was an amazing person. She had a big heart. She was wicked smart, so smart. Like, who actually graduates ahead of time? She is the smartest person I know that made the worst decisions in life. She just, I don't know. She actually was a good person. Like, she really was. She wasn't out to hurt anyone. There was not a malicious bone in her body. She loved people. She loved just having fun. She never took life too serious. And all around, she was a really good person. And, you know, I think that's what gets lost on these people who are addicts and turn to the streets or turn to the drugs or alcohol. You have to remember who they were before that. I think my mom just struggled her whole life and there really was nothing. She just made really, really awful decisions and she paid the ultimate price.
Michelle Louise Mercer went missing on or around February 6th, 2006 from the White Avenue area of Edmonton, Alberta. No matter the lifestyle that Michelle chose, she does not deserve to be missing from her family. And her family deserves answers. So if you or anyone you know has any information that could assist the Edmonton Police Service in locating Michelle, please call them at 780-423-4567 with the file number 06112098. At the time of her disappearance, Michelle is described as a white woman, 46 years old, 5'5", 130 pounds, and she has grayish brown hair and blue eyes. We'd like to thank Jackie and Tammy for speaking with us and sharing their family's story. If you or anyone you know is struggling with substance misuse, there is help available. You're not alone, and I hope this episode confirmed that for you. There are many resources available to Canadians, which we will link in the show notes of this episode. We hope you were able to take something away from this episode of True North True Crime. We will see you soon with a brand new episode. So until then, stay safe, everyone.
Stay safe.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.